ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Australian men and women are different, on average, in their answers to these questions. Winning is the most important thing. Sometimes violent action is necessary, and it bothers me when I have to ask for help. Partly as a result, on average, Australian men die younger than Australian women. They're also more likely to kill, as well as be killed, and more likely to commit sexual assault. The more masculine, typically masculine, their answers, the more dangerous they're likely to be. It's a global phenomenon, but just about the best place to examine it turns out to be here in Australia. Because when it comes to men, parts of Australia turn out to have been exquisitely unusual, making them unusually dangerous. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and two researchers who are using parts of Australia to examine what excessively high masculinity scores would mean for the world, economists Pauline Grosjean from the University of New South Wales and Victoria Baranoff from the University of Melbourne. Victoria's just been named this year's Young Economist of the Year. Welcome, Pauline, and congratulations, Victoria.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having us.
Pauline, what you are doing and what researchers elsewhere are now beginning to do is unusual. Economists often examine female behaviour, the things that make women different, but they rarely examine male behaviour. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think implicitly there's this idea that the male behavior is the optimal, rational, you know, default thing to do.
Normal.
Yeah, the normal thing. And that women just have to catch up to close gender gaps, right? And so most of the analysis has been focusing on women and trying to understand the roles that biological factors, the legal environment, the institutional environment, social norms may play in explaining why women essentially don't behave like men.
Victoria, other disciplines, anthropology, evolutionary biology, have done a good deal of work identifying particularly masculine characteristics. What are the main ones? What can we say they are?
So the other disciplines that have in particular focused on masculinity norms have actually been sociology and psychology and a bit of anthropology as well. And according to these disciplines, they have identified several core, or sometimes they call it traditional, masculinity norms. And these would include expectations that men would behave in ways that are self-reliant, assertive, competitive, dominant, sometimes violent when needed, seeking power and status. So those would be the core masculinity norms that we sort of consider and study in our work.
What are the consequences of those norms for men and women? I suppose beginning with health.
Before we talk about consequences, I think maybe we should start with associations or correlations, because consequences are difficult to establish, right? That's cause and effect. Just to start with associations, what we know for many studies, including in psychology, sociology, and public health, is that men who adhere more strongly to these core masculinity norms, they have higher rates of depression, higher rates of suicidal ideation. And in our global work, we also document these types of associations or correlations that are consistently present across 70 countries where we've surveyed over 100,000 people.
And these are bad for men, although you said we can only say with certainty that they're association. I think the deaths from drugs, alcohol, and suicide are three times more likely in men than women, and partly as a result, men don't live as long. Is it that men are violent to each other? Is it that they're less likely to ask for help? Is it all of those things?
Yes, men are more likely to die. They have higher rates of mortality around the world and at basically at every single age group. And those have been linked, but again, not causally, to these beliefs that men shouldn't ask for help, that they can be violent and they should be violent, that they should take excessive risks and so forth.
What about the impact on politics, Pauline? Where male traits are strong, what sort of leaders are men most likely to support?
What we measure in our survey around the world is really adherence to the core masculinity norms that Victoria was talking about, right? So self-reliance, endorsement of hierarchy, violence, these type of things. And so what we observe is that men who adhere more strongly to these masculinity norms are more supportive of authoritarian rule, including rule by the army. They're more opposed to liberal values of democracy and even market economy. And these associations are very strong and they're prevalent in most of the countries in the survey. And it's interesting to see that they're particularly strong in what we can characterize as advanced democracies, right? And so we offer a lot of discussion in the paper about the discussions that have been going on recently about democratic backsliding or the kind of threat to democratic institutions that we observe in advanced democracies, including, you know, Australia and other European countries and the US, as we can witness at the moment. And we see how much of the support for this type of right-wing authoritarianism is explained by people's adherence to these core masculinity norms.
Would that be because the adherence, at least in some areas, some geographical areas and perhaps some social media areas, adherence to those norms is growing?
So there is a lot of work at the moment looking at the role of social media and in particular what people characterize as the manosphere. And that's a difficult object to measure. But, you know, one thing that you can simply do is just look at what kind of content men are more likely to consume online compared to women, right? And we know that these online environments are very gender segregated. Men and women consume very different content. So if you look at content that is almost exclusively consumed by men, you could call that the manosphere, and you do see that they do channel or advertise these restrictive masculinity norms that we have been talking about. And that explains a substantial proportion of what we see in the US and in other advanced democracies, again, is this emergence of this gender gap in politics where young men become very supportive of the type of right-wing authoritarianism that is offered by some political parties, when women, young women, are not so much the case. And this is a new phenomenon because, you know, young people used to be more progressive than older generation and women and men equally. But what we see now is that we see these young men becoming much more conservative and much more supportive of these authoritarian movements. So there's a connection here between the core masculinity norms that are advertised and encouraged by this podcast and some political consequences.
Victoria, before social media, leaving social media, leaving the manosphere out of it, what are the conditions in which these masculine traits are likely to be the most extreme, I suppose, not only for people, but also for other creatures?
Right. So we know from an extensive literature in evolutionary biology, stemming back to Darwin, when females are scarce, that is, when males outnumber females, males tend to change their behavior. They become more competitive, more aggressive, and more violent. And there's a pretty large literature across the sciences that has documented this, as you say, in numerous species, you know, lizards, primates, as well as in humans contemporaneously. So we know that, you know, a scarcity or an imbalance of women in the population creates this sort of immediate response among the men that they want to compete for the scarce females for mating opportunities.
Pauline, we might even be seeing that in the manosphere, might we? In that, while there isn't necessarily in the locations where people are part of the manosphere, where men are listening, consuming content, there mightn't be an imbalance in the sex ratio. In a sense, in the manosphere, there is.
Well, so as I said, like, it's a very gender segregated environment, right? So I think these men do not interact with many women. And so there's this perceived scarcity, perhaps. And this is exactly the kind of idea is discussed a lot in the manosphere, just how hard it is to get women, because women only go for one certain type of man. So there is this engineered, if you want, scarcity that is definitely part of the discourse.
If we want to get a picture of what a larger manosphere would be likely to give us, one of the best places in the world to look turns out to be right here in Australia. It's because of our relatively recent past, as you're about to discover here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guests, economists Pauline Grosjean from the University of New South Wales and Victoria Baranoff from the University of Melbourne. Pauline, what happened in Australia 160 to 240 years ago, and what was so unusual about it?
The almost perfect natural historical experiment to study the consequences of male bias sex ratio, right? So we see male bias sex ratios in many different parts of the world today, so most notably in China and India, as a result of sex selective abortion. So we know that there's more men compared to women, but it's very difficult to know whether we see more sexist norms, for example, creating the imbalance in the sex ratio, or the imbalance in the sex ratio creating the sexist norm. So what you would need to study the causal consequence of imbalanced sex ratio, you would need, say, an island isolated from the rest of the world where you would drop randomly different numbers of men compared to women with an excess of men. And this is essentially what convict transportation has created in Australia. Because you basically took a quite homogeneous population out of England and Ireland and dropped them in different amounts and different proportions in different areas of Australia. And the sex ratio was very male biased because there were many more male convicts compared to female convicts because of representation in crime and also the tendency to transport men compared to women.
How biased? This is way beyond what we'd be seeing in China at the moment, Ashu.
Yes. So to do this research, we collected what is essentially the first usable census in the different areas of Australia. And so what we see in our data is that we see, I think, average sex ratio among convicts, about 28 men for every woman.
That's extreme.
Yes. And then it's also interesting because we're able to measure the population of Australia quite early on. And so convicts are actually quite a large proportion of the population of Australia when we measure it.
We should remember that Indigenous populations were not counted.
Not until the 1960s, yes.
Australia isn't the only place, I guess, to have had these extreme ratios. The UK sent convicts to what's now the United States as well. But I guess we've got the best data because it's happened here most recently. I'm wondering, though, whether these regions where convicts settled, and that's what you've looked at what's happening today in those regions where convicts predominated. I'm wondering, though, whether that does give us sort of a clean, natural experiment because those locations would have been different in another way because they hosted criminals who were criminals perhaps more violent than other settlers.
So the first thing I want to say is about how criminal they were. They were actually not violent criminals, right? So the violent criminals in Victoria and England were executed. They were not transported to Australia for most of them. And so historians and economic historians have shown that actually the population of people who were convict transported to Australia was actually quite representative of the general population in England and Ireland at the time.
They were just unlucky in a way.
Yes, and you know, we know for sure that two-thirds of transported convicts were are convicted for petty crime, sometimes first offender of stealing an apple. So these are really petty crimes, right? So the second thing as well is that we try to understand, you know, what determines their allocation across different areas in Australia. And it's mostly determined by labor needs at the time. And we actually have quotes from the governor of New South Wales who explained that he was organizing the convicts in his book and then deciding where these people would go. And so once you condition on the kind of geographic endowment and the different labor needs at the time, then the residual variation is as good as random, essentially.
Victoria, what are your findings? What you have done is to look at conditions today, 160 to 240 years later, in those regions. Northern Tasmania is one of them. Northern New South Wales is another, in those regions that used to be hotspots of extreme male-biased sex ratios. How are they different from Australia today? Can we start with what happened in World War One?
So what we do is now we are comparing different regions that are actually quite close to each other. So regions within New South Wales that had higher historical sex ratios during the convict era to other places, again, within New South Wales that had lower male biased sex ratios. So we have that variation. And in World War One data, as we're looking at voluntary enlistments to World War One from Tasmania, and that Tasmanian data, and what we see is that individuals from historically male-biased sex ratios, and by the time that World War One was happening, the sex ratio in the population had actually already mostly equalized, meaning there was
influence on
the historical influence of male bias in the past during the convict era still had an effect in terms of more men voluntarily enlisting for World War One, which is of course a very risky prospect.
One fifth of the people died, right?
Exactly,
very risky.
Yeah, very risky. But it is also sort of a time when Australia was, entering the world stage as a new nation. And it was a lot of rhetoric about standing up for your nation. But there was also a lot of ostracizing men who didn't stand up and who were cowards if they didn't enlist.
They were seen as weak, right? They were sent feathers in the mail.
Exactly, the white feather.
So it was a real challenge to masculinity norms. Mm-hmm. What do we know then about today? Violence, suicide, mental health, a century or more on. And the ratios are not in any particular way unbalanced today. But what do we see in those locations?
We continue to see that these historically male-biased postcodes today are more likely to have more assaults and sexual assaults, but importantly, not property crime. So it's not just about criminality. It is specifically about aggression and aggressive behavior. We also see higher rates of male suicide, but not female suicide. So it's not just sort of something about suicide rates. It's specifically about male suicide. And we see higher rates of prostate cancer. And then in other survey data, we find deaths from prostate cancer. And then we see in other data that corroborates this, that we see that men are less likely to screen for prostate cancer, which is consistent with a health avoidance or help avoidance type of behavior. Again, consistent with masculinity norms.
Some of these numbers in your paper are really big. A one standard deviation increase in the sex ratios in the past results today in almost a 9% increase in assault, almost a 13% increase in sexual assaults, a 20% increase in male suicide. And today, even when we had the COVID vaccine, an 18%, I suppose, decline in willingness of men, but not women, to get the vaccine. I'm trying, Pauline, to get my head around this because although it's a short time ago in the span of history, these male bias sex ratios are a long time ago in our lifetimes. How could they have been transmitted within geographical regions?
So there's several channels of transmission that explain these results, right? So the first is in families. So young kids are educated in a familial environment that transmits values and norms. The second one is that it's the sort of environment that you interact with. So we haven't talked about one of the outcomes that we look at, bullying in schools. And we see that in areas of Australia that were more male-biased in the past, boys, and again, not girls, are more likely to be bullied at school. And this is very important if you think about the socialization of violence, right?
This can be a way of enforcing norms.
Yeah, exactly, right? And this is, even if your parents tell you that you should be nonviolent, and so even if you're not socialized into this idea that you should be violent and you should stand up for yourself and, you know, defend yourself and defend your honor or masculinity or whatever, if you arrive in a violent environment, the best response is to be violent, right? And so you're going to have this lock-in, this equilibrium that is going to persist over time because it's everybody's best response to adhere to the norm. It's very hard, especially for children, to deviate from a norm. And this is how norms get transmitted over time, both within families and then within the kind of common environment that people interact with, and particularly schools.
Even over generations, it would be not my dad, not my grandpa, maybe my great-grandpa or something like that, if I was in one of these locations that a long time ago had an extreme mismatch.
Yes.
Extremely male-skewed. Even that many generations, we see, I think one of your figures here is that in reports of bullying, an 8% increase, again, with a standard deviation.
That's right. And I think it's also the kind of ideals and ideas and norms that society valorizes and glorifies, right? So a few months ago, I drove from Sydney to Canberra, and the whole road is a glorification of male soldiers. And you know, Australia is a society that glorifies its military past, right? And there's many reasons for why that might be the case. It is one example of other socialization process, if you want, you know, who we regard as valuable individuals and what kind of behavior we admire in people.
Is there a difference, Victoria, between what men think in their heart of hearts when they answer these questions throughout the world and what they think other men think?
What you're asking about is, do men, if they're asked the question of should men be able to ask for help or do they really need to be super self-reliant? If you ask them that question, oftentimes you'll see that men personally might respond, I think it's okay for men to ask for help. But then when you ask them the question of, what do you think other men or other people think? Is it okay for men to ask for help? They will say no. Other people actually think that it's not okay, that men, other people think that men should be self-reliant.
Pauline, what do we know about political attitudes all these years, this 1 to 2 centuries later? What do we know about how those locations, of course in Australia we don't record how men and women vote, we don't separate it out that way, but what do we know about how those locations that once had very high male to female ratios, how they voted in the same-sex marriage referendum?
So we see that there is much lower support for the same-sex marriage referendum in areas that were more male-based in the past. And one of the things that we measure in the Global Masculinity Survey is attitudes around the importance to be perceived as heterosexual. And I want to say something more about politics, is that this is not a left-right issue. If we look at, you know, in Australia, whether people in more male-biased sex ratio area vote in election results, we don't see major differences. And I think if we look at the manosphere today, again, there is left-wing podcasts and right-wing podcasts. So really, it's not so much about the left-right. It's really about this core masculinity dimension that we were looking at, you know, support for violence, self-reliance, disdain for homosexual, and support for authoritarianism and army rule and this sort of like tough leadership views.
Does your work, and you, Pauline, you've credited your co-authors, but you were the first person with another co-author to have looked at the impact of those sex ratios in our convict past. Does it provide us with an insight into what's in store, perhaps for generations to come, if the sort of attitudes being stirred up in the manosphere spread?
Yes, I think to me that's the scariest message. Historical conditions that happened, you know, hundreds of years ago, even though they have disappeared, they shape norms in ways that go well beyond the generation that was impacted. But it's also something that also suggests that cultural norms can change, right? So persistence is not determinism. So I think this is why this research is so important, because I really want people to understand to what extent their own actions and their own beliefs do not reflect rational and optimal responses to their current environment, but really the weight of history. And the second thing is that it's the point about pluralistic ignorance is the fact that often we act in expectations of others' expectations, not in ways that we would want to act. And, you know, in a way, the message that I would want to give is that people need to sort of free themselves from others' people's expectations that are often erroneous and inherited from past conditions.
It was John Maynard Keynes, the legendary economist, who said that rational people who believe they're making their own decisions are the servants of some long-dead economist. It might be that we're the servants of things a long time ago, even though we like to think we're making our own decisions. Victoria, and this is the last question, I suppose, behind this whole discussion has lied the idea that extreme masculine traits are a bad thing, that it'd be better if we had less of them. Should we be less stereotypically masculine? Would that be a good thing, or is it more complicated? Maybe there are good things.
No, we actually take a, you know, we don't take a stance on whether or not masculinity is good or bad. It's a diverse set of expectations that is not a singular, it's not a monolithic single one. It's just sets of them, and some of them could be beneficial in some cases and harmful in other cases. There's also a psychological cost or a tension of behaving and presenting in the world in a way that actually diverges from your who you are, you know, at the core. So you might be a competitive person by nature, and that's fine. But say you behave competitively or act tough just because that's expected of you because you're a man. So you go out in the world and you sort of put this cloak on just because of expectation. I think there's a psychological cost to that as well. And I think that's what we're sometimes seeing in a lot of the psychological depression data that we're finding in the various data sources that we look.
On that topic, I should say that if today's episode has raised any issues for you or someone you know, if they need support, help is available, Lifeline 131114 or 1-800-RESPECT, 1-800-737-737. Both services are free, confidential and available 24 hours a day. Thank you both so much for, I suppose, turning the tables on the idea that females are the special case in economics when males certainly seem to be a special case. Before we go, Victoria and Pauline, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Victoria?
I think this is actually coming up in a few months, so perhaps towards the end of the year, we'll be releasing a State of Australian Men, a report in collaboration with the Jesuit Social Services and Equimondo to look into issues around masculinity, online lives, but we don't know what the data will show yet.
Pauline, what are you looking out for?
I'm French and I just came back from Europe, where you now see extreme fires to the scale of Australian fires in temperate forests. Yeah, it's just a call for economists and, you know, people more generally to study more issues that are really vital for our survival, environmental issues in particular.
Thank you, economist Pauline Grosjean from the University of New South Wales and Victoria Baranoff, this year's Young Economist of the Year from the University of Melbourne. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. If you've any thoughts or questions or comments, you well might. No economic question is stupid. You can email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. You can hear this program on Radio National on Thursdays. Listen to it on the ABC app. And there are show notes, links to Victoria and Pauline's papers for you to read at your leisure. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.